Okay, so I often find it astonishing, again, in a halachic context, how we spend so much time talking about holiness and sanctity and what couples can do and what they can't do. And as I said, shomer negiah, they shouldn't touch before they're married, and even after they're married, there may or may not be restrictions, as we'll see. And in September, actually the end of August, I was in the States and I picked up a Vanity Fair while I was waiting for a manicure, because you know that's what you do. And this article, I shouldn't even say the word is astonished, but so disturbed me that it really became, again, as I meet with rabbis who say you can do this, but you can't do that, and in the dark or the light, or the, I read this article about an app called Tinder. And at the same time, the Ashley Madison website had been hacked. There were something like 170,000 users in Israel. And in the world, I think it was 32 million. Again, the statistics are boggling. Ashley Madison's motto was, "Life is too short, have an affair." And whether these tens of millions of people were having affairs or were signed up with the thought of having an affair is really irrelevant. But it made me realize that, we're not doing anyone a favor by creating a lot of guilt and repression and oppression in the ethics of Jewish sexuality when we have much bigger things to contend with, which is a world that's extremely promiscuous. Now, I'll just pause and say, anyone who has studied sexuality knows it's been promiscuous since the day the world was created. Okay, I know we like to think that in 2015, wow, we're really promiscuous. But if you go back and read Responsa from the Middle Ages, or you go back to the Talmud period, certainly, the Muslim communities 100, 200, 300 years ago, and again, I can only talk about the Jewish piece, but I'm sure this is reflective of the world at large. There was a lot of promiscuity. There were a lot of affairs to the point, and this is a beauty. The Shulchan Aruch says that the husband of the wife will be considered the father for a full 12 months after, she becomes pregnant and he's been away. But if he's been away for less than 12 months, then the child can be attributed to him. Meaning again, pregnancy is usually 9 months, 10, right? If you want, depending on when you want to start counting, they're willing to go the extra 2 months to make sure paternity is attributed to the husband and avoid calling the child a mamzer, which is not a bastard. And in English, a bastard is a child from an illegitimate relationship, a non-marital relationship. In halacha, it's only incest or the product of a married woman with a Jewish man, a married woman with a Jewish man, not her husband. So in order to avoid mamzerut, they extend pregnancy to 12 months, essentially. So if the husband had last been seen 12 months earlier and she gave birth clearly while he was away, but it was within 12 months, the child would be attributed. So if you begin to read, not to mention homosexuality between older men and young boys, was quite rampant in Islamic countries, certainly in the 1800s, so despite the rabbis protesting. So while we tend to be very Puritan in our attitudes, and today, lo aleinu, woe is us, let us, all put our heads down at how promiscuous the world is, it's always been promiscuous. There's always been prostitution. There's always been non-marital sex. Talmud, the Tractate of Ketubot, is filled with non-virgins. Even though it starts out that a virgin's worth more than a non-virgin, if you read the tractate, and we'll do that some of that next week, we'll read some of those mishnas, it's clear to the rabbis of the Talmudic period that many women arrive at the wedding canopy non-virginal. And then what are you going to do with them? Okay, what's going to be the consequence? Are we going to believe the woman when she bursts into tears and said, "I had an accident with a pole," or "there was the milkman and it was before I even met my husband, so it wasn't adult," and so on and so forth. But they have all sorts of situations that they take into. What has really changed today, and that's what we're going to look at, is the internet. And I can't deny that is a tremendous change, because the anonymity the internet provides for sexual encounters, porn, and so on, is unlike anything we've had before. And obviously, the consequences are still being studied. I'm just going to quickly read through some of this on the first page. It's a balmy night in Manhattan's financial district, and at a sports bar called Stout, everyone is tindering. The tables are filled with young women and men who've been chasing money and deals on Wall Street all day, and now they're all looking for hookups. Everyone is drinking, peering into their screens, and swiping on the faces of strangers they may have sex with later that evening. So again, the idea of the Tinder app is people who sign up for this app, you get the face of someone within your radius, and you can, you know, kind of swipe on their picture and, you know, send a request to meet up later. At a booth in the back, three handsome 20-something guys in button-downs are having beers. They are Dan, Alex, and Marty, budding investment bankers at the same financial firm which recruited Alex and Marty straight from an Ivy League campus. When asked if they've been arranging dates on the apps they've been swiping at, all say not one date, but two or three. You can't be stuck in one lane. There's always something better. If you had a reservation somewhere and that a table at Per Se opened up, you'd want to go there, Alex offers. Guys view everything as competition, he elaborates. Who slept with the best, hottest girls? With these dating apps, he says, you're always sort of prowling. You can talk to two or three girls at a bar and pick the best one, or you can swipe a couple hundred people a day. The same sample size is so much larger. It's setting up two or three Tinder dates a week, and chances are sleeping with all of them so you can rack up 100 girls you've slept with in a year. He says that he himself has slept with five different women he met on Tinder, Tinderellas, the girls call, guys call them. In the last eight days, Dan and Marty, also Alex's roommates in a shiny high-rise apartment building near Wall Street, can vouch for that. In fact, they can remember whom Alex has slept with in the past week more readily than he can. And then I'm going to go to the next page, to the last paragraph. It's instant gratification, says Jason, and a validation of your own attractiveness by just like swiping your thumb on an app. You see some pretty girl and you swipe and it's like, oh, she thinks you're attractive too, so it's really addicting. And you just find yourself mindlessly doing it. Sex has become so easy. I can go on my phone right now and no doubt I can find someone I can have sex with this evening, probably before midnight. And is this good for women? Since the emergence of flappers and moderns in the 1920s, the debate about what is lost and gained for women in casual sex has been raging and is raging still, particularly among women. The hookup culture is bound up with everything that's fabulous about being a young woman in 2012, the freedom, the confidence, but others lament the way the extreme casualness of sex in the age of Tinder leaves many women feeling devalued. The article went on. If you want to find the article, you can. This article was well beyond kind of the last article I had read in the New York Times about the hookup culture. There the title was, "In Hookup Culture, Inequality Still Reigns." It was a study of something, tens of thousands of college students, women and men who are both looking for hookups. Hookups are one-night stands. The difference there, of course, was at least you saw the person face-to-face in the bar. Maybe he bought you a drink before you went home. Here, you don't even have that. You have, like, an SMS. Do you want to hook up, right? I don't even know who you are. Based on your picture, you know, I'm going to go meet you somewhere. So it's even more anonymous. And ultimately, in this study that was done by the Kinsey Institute, I think, there were two studies done, one at Northwestern and one at the Kinsey Institute. They found that women enjoy hookups less physiologically. It's not that they're not interested in the hookup culture. It's just that it's harder for them to enjoy hookup sex because women are more complicated, and all, you know, all the men here can nod. Women are more complicated than men in so many ways, and sexually, meaning it's more complicated to have a one-night stand if you're a woman than if you're a man. To have sexual pleasure. And so I bring this because we're about to talk about sanctity and sexuality, and what I've just described, Tinder, the hookup culture, and so on, there's no sanctity there. Meaning, I had a student at Pardes last year approach me and say, yeah, he knows what I'm talking about. He thinks of it as junk sex, kind of like junk food, right? You finish the bag of potato chips in 5 minutes, but then you feel really sick. There's a similar analogy to this kind of mindless, nameless, faceless sex. It feels really good when you do it, but it really is a lot like junk food. And we both agreed that there's no, you know, in the course of the conversation, you can't sanctify that. Meaning, if I talk about sanctity and sexuality and I say, well, maybe in non-marital sexual relationships or homosexual relationships, there can be sanctity. And I think there can be. There can't be sanctity in this promiscuous culture of people going home and not really knowing one another and having sex. So I bring that because I think that adults today, children, adults, young adults, you know, are confronting, you know, kind of from all sides, what was the right word, messages from the television they watch and the computer games and the computer they watch and so on and so forth that encourages this kind of sexuality. And I think one of our jobs as, or one of the things we're we really need to think about is how to educate towards, some sort of sanctity in a world that is so promiscuous. And I think Judaism gives us the ability to do so, and that's where I'm going to start. If we take a look at the first source, Bereishit Rabbah, Vayar Elohim et kol asher asah v'hineh tov ma'od. I'll already say that Sefer Bereishit, if you want Jewish texts, Jewish stories about sex, just open the Torah. Meaning, I actually went through all the parshas in Bereishit in my mind. Until Miketz, you more or less have a parsha a week in which you can have a conversation with the people around your table about sexual values and sexual ethics. Meaning, Sefer Bereishit is really presents sexuality, creates sexuality, and then spends quite a bit of time explaining about the different dangers that sexuality presents to the world. So we have here, Ve'ar Elohim et kol asher asah v'hineh tov ma'od. Nachman b'shem Rabbi Shmuel, hineh tov ma'od zeyetzer tov. So Nachman in the name of Rabbi Shmuel says, it was very good. This is the good inclination. And behold, it was very good. This is the evil inclination. Now that's a fascinating observation, because basically what this midrash is saying, and here I'll quote Daniel Boyarin in a book he calls Carnal Israel, it's a rejection of ethical dualism. In other words, we tend to very much look at the Yetzer HaTov and the Yetzer Hara, the good inclination and the evil inclination, as being two forces of that kind of move within us and influence us to make decisions. And it's like they're, we have dual nature of the ethical tension that man confronts. But by calling the Yetzer Hara Tov Ma'od, essentially it's a rejection, and what it's saying is that the Yetzer, or desire, is neither good nor bad. And ultimately, it's what defines it is what people do with it. But it has the potential to be Tov Ma'od. I mean, it is Tov Ma'od at its essence, but it's also Yetzer Hara, meaning it's an interesting dialectic, but really it's one and the same. Meaning, Yetzer Hara, evil inclination, equals, and it is very good. It is very good. And so what we see here is an understanding that it's not that the sexual component, the Yetzer, what they're talking about the evil inclination, and they're really talking about sexual desire, because it says, rather, without the evil inclination, a person would not build a house, not marry a woman, and not beget children, is an understanding that from the very beginning, sexuality is what allows the world to continue. And it is Tov Ma'od, even at the same time as it poses challenges of Yetzer Hara, of being both, having destructive power to it. And I think Chazal, or the rabbinic tradition, was very aware about the destructive power of sexual desire, while at the same time embracing and empowering sexuality. And so a lot of the sources I'm now going to bring are going to confront that tension. Sex is really physical. Sex is something that really requires us to use our bodies. And sexual pleasure requires a certain amount of release and understand. There's something very immodest about sexuality. And yet, there is no point in, certainly in rabbinic tradition, where it's ever suggested that we move towards celibacy or asceticism. Even as Christianity at this time was very much moving in that direction, they called Israel carnal. That's the name. His book, Carnal Israel, is taken from a Christian critique of Judaism. Judaism never moved in that direction, and I would like to suggest it's because of how the world was created. We're going to look at that shortly. What I want to look at is this source, Yoma 69b. They cried unto God in a loud voice. Ve'yitzaku al Adonai Elohim b'kol gadol. It's from Nehemiah. What did they say? Rav says, woe, woe, this is the one who destroyed the temple and burned the holy place and killed all of the righteous ones and exiled Israel from their land, and still he dances among us. What is the reason you gave him to us? Is it not to receive reward for resisting him? We don't want his reward. It's talking here about the inclination to worship idols. This piece is talking about the drive towards idolatry. And so, ultimately, Israel, in this story, are willing to reject reward in favor of getting rid of the temptation to worship idols, which makes sense. It's in Nehemiah. They worshipped a lot of idols. A shard essentially fell from heaven with the word truth written on it. Said Rav Chanina, learn from this that the seal of the Holy One, blessed be he, Holy Blessed One, is truth. They sat and fast for 3 days and three nights, and he was given over to them, and so on. Essentially, they eradicate the desire to worship idols. That's a known tradition, that between the first and second temple, one of the differences was that the desire to worship idols was eradicated. If you turn to the next page, though, they think, well, maybe we should get rid of the desire for sexual sin. Life will be really simple then. No desire to worship idols, and no desire to have sexual acts that are not mandated. And so life will be very simple, and we'll just go back to Eden, if you will, and everyone will do what God wants. They said, since it is a time of God's favor, let us pray regarding desire for sexual sin. They prayed, and he was committed into their hands. He said to them, be careful, for if you kill that one, the world will end. They imprisoned him for 3 days, sexual desire, and then they looked for a fresh egg in all of the land of Israel, and they did not find one. They said, what shall we do? If we kill him, the world will end. If we pray for half, in heaven they do not answer halfway prayers. Blind him and let him go. At least a man does not become aroused by his female relatives, which is astonishing because it suggests that they were, you know, that piece they got rid of, but there was, the idea of being aroused by your female relatives was not, out of the question before, they got rid of this piece of sexual desire. But what they're basically saying is similar to the idea of that source in Bereshit Rabba. Without sexual desire, the world cannot continue. We can't kill it. There's no attempt to really even move away from it. We have to embrace it. We have to figure out ways to sanctify it, but we can't kill it. If we take a look at Sukkah 52a, I'm going to go through this one quickly. The northern one I will remove from among you, a source from Joel. This is the evil desire which is hidden and present in the heart of man. For it has performed mightily. Now Abaye tells a story. Among the Torah scholars, more than anyone, is there this evil desire. As in the story of Abaye, who heard a certain man saying to a woman, let us get up early and go together on the way. He, Abaye, said, I will go and separate them from doing that which is forbidden. He went behind them for three parasangs in a meadow. That's quite a long length, meaning miles and miles they're keeping company. When they separated from each other, he heard them saying, our way is long and our company is sweet. Said Abaye, if that had been me, I would not have been able to control myself. He went and swung on the door hinge and was miserable. A certain old man went by, meaning it's always good when old men in the story are often the Saba, the wise man, and taught him, everyone who is greater than his fellow, his desire is also greater. That's the comfort, right? There are similar stories with Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Meir, again, the Talmudic sages of the Talmud, the great sages of the Talmud, both of whom scoff at those who are tempted toward sexual impropriety, until one day each of them see a woman who is unbelievably beautiful, and like Tarzan, they take a rope and swing across the river to get at this beautiful woman who turns out to be Eliyahu HaNavi. So lo and behold, Eliyahu HaNavi, they kind of tempted fate by not understanding the danger of sexual desire. They are then led to understand how powerful that desire can be. They experience it themselves, and then, of course, they are humbled. So it's interesting, again, the Talmud has more, quite a few sources in which it's understood that Torah scholars are prone to strong sexual desire, and they have to learn to control it, clearly. Of course, the flip side will be they're the ones who will be most enmeshed in Torah study, meaning they'll take that sexual desire and translate it into sitting and learning Torah for 12 years, 13 years. Maybe that's a different class that I teach, how men go away for 12 or 13 years, leaving their wives behind, and essentially the learning of Torah becomes the world of desire for them. But again, that's a different class. That line that the old man says, everyone who is greater than his fellow, his desire is greater also, suggests, again, something that unfortunately we have seen, that learning Torah does not protect you. And we were rather, what is the right word, self-righteous, if you will, when the Catholic Church started uncovering the decades of sexual abuse in the church. And I remember, certainly me, but I felt like, those around me also contributed to this. Oh, that's because they're celibate. But we encourage marriage. We're a sexual, we allow kosher sex. And so we're not going to have those problems. And lo and behold, we have those problems as well. And part of the challenge, of course, is the fact that we've had to, and it's traumatic to face the fact that just because someone learns a lot of Torah does not mean that they are protected from sexual impropriety, sexual desire, homosexual acts, sex with married women, and And there's almost been a myth that we don't have to worry. A rabbi would never do that. And unfortunately, here I would suggest Abaye is very well aware of how strong his sexual desire is, and he's almost envious of those who have more control than he. And I feel like, again, the Talmud was certainly aware of the fact that ein apotropis la'arayot, there is no guardian over sexual impropriety, meaning anyone can fall. You must always be mindful and aware. And the greater the dissociation from one's desire, the more inclined you are to sin. I'm going to skip the next source. Again, I'll talk about it a little later. Okay. What I want to look at next is Bereishit, the parsha just a few days ago. We have two versions of creation. We have the version where God creates man in his image. He creates zachar and nekeva, and then he tells man and woman to procreate. That's chapter one. In chapter two, we have a different model, very important model, where basically here Adam searches for a ezer kenegdo. He doesn't find the ezer kenegdo. I'll just say, you know, if you really want to do the interpretation right on this chapter, you can spend several weeks at Pardes. But, you know, I'm just going to skip down to Pasuk Kaf Dalet 24. Al ken yazov ish et aviv et imo v'davak b'ishto v'hayu l'basar echad. I think one of the most powerful psukim in the Torah, that when man discovers woman, this is the reason. Of course, Adam doesn't have a father and mother. The stand-in would be God, if you will. So again, interesting that only now is Adam able to go cleave to another, which is his wife, and they shall be one flesh. It's not procreation we're talking about here. I mean, again, it's an idea Michael Gold developed about is God in the bedroom. This idea that there are two models. There's sexual relations that lead to procreation, to children, but there's a different model, which is dveikut, which is how people come together. A sex therapist I heard in one of the courses I took, whose name escapes me now, talked about the fact that sexual desire is the energy that brings people together. Dveikut is what keeps people together, right? The idea that when you recognize that there's another person in the relationship, it's not just about one's own personal pleasure, but there's dveikut, you become basar achad, which is also physical, but could also be spiritual. That's what the sexual relationship can strive to be. And that's chapter two. And it's very significant because, again, Judaism embraces sexuality. And I would suggest it's because of the way it interprets chapter two in Bereishit, this idea that man and woman were created to cleave to one another sexually, to have the dveikut. The word davak, dalid bet kuf, is also used to describe the close relationship we have with God, meaning it's used as a verb many times in prophets. And so the fact that the sexual union can reflect our relationship with God does not escape the Kabbalah's attention. We'll see a little bit of Kabbalah, but I think is deliberate. Again, sexuality can create dveikut between husband and wife and also within our relationship with God. I'm going to skip Rabbeinu Bachaye. Again, I'm also going to skip Sota and Rabbi Yaakov Emden. This idea that sexual connection leads to holiness, I don't think I need to prove to you, but you're certainly welcome to read that. The next section, which I'm going to, again, go through quickly because I really want to get to the source in Nidarim, is what I call the Kedoshim Tihiyu section. And really, again, what you have here, God says, you shall be holy because I, the Lord, your God, am holy. Kedusha really is about separation, if you will, sanctity through separating ourselves in various aspects of our lives, whether it's food or clothing or agriculture, the way we, you know, that appears in the end, and obviously sexual conduct is one of the main ways in which we are kadosh, in which we are sanctified towards God. Rashi, interestingly enough, feels that kedusha, you shall be holy, where it's underlined, for wherever one finds a fence around sexual immorality, one finds holiness, really emphasizes the integration of holiness and sexual immorality. In other words, where there's immorality, there cannot be holiness. And holiness, however, can infuse the sexual relationship if you don't commit incest, adultery, homosexuality, bestiality, and sexual relations with a menstruating woman. What is not on that list is premarital sexuality. I mean, nowhere in the Torah, and we'll talk about that next week, is it prohibited to have non-marital, I'm going to call it non-marital, because it could be it's not pre, it could be it's post, meaning non-marital sexual relations, as long as it's not with a woman who is menstruating. Okay, and so it's interesting that, you know. Mm-hmm. Well, no, that's adultery. I said adultery. Rashi very much emphasizing this integration. Ramban, Nachmanides, really not liking that, because Ramban feels you are overly simplifying or narrowing the definition of holiness. And the Ramban, and again, I'm not going to read it. I urge you to read it on your own. He talks about moderation, that really what you're looking for is a balance between asceticism and hedonism, that you could be a really from a yid, right? You could be a Jew who really, you know, wears the shtreimel and the gartel. You have all the clothing and all the gear, and you look really, really very stark, as they say. But if you're a glutton, if you end up overeating at every meal, you're very kosher meat and you're very kosher food. You drink endless amounts of wine, but it's kosher wine. I'm using food because that's the easiest example of gluttony. You have five, you know, your conspicuous consumption is extreme, even if you have the money. The Ramban would look at that as the antithesis of holiness. It's much trickier. It's much trickier. It's actually more powerful, because Ramban is saying it's not good enough to do the mitzvahs. To be holy, you have to think about what you're doing. There has to be a certain amount of mindfulness in what you do. And so that if you overdo anything, if you speak with profanities, but you don't use God's name, you're not necessarily violating any mitzvahs, but there's something anti-holy about that. There's something profane in the profane sense, not chulin. Igra Gered HaKodesh, I'm going to have to skip. It's a Kabbalistic work. It's very interesting. Again, it was thought to be written by Ramban, and it fits very well with what Ramban, you know, writes in other places. However, scholars have discovered it's not really Ramban. It's not Nachmanides, but it was written in the 13th century. It's a Kabbalistic work. And there it talks a lot about the fact of how sexuality can be holiness, and that what makes it not holy is when one degrade, you know, the idea of one's behavior, foolish behavior, degrading behavior creates ugliness, but that there's nothing ugly about the sexual relationship or the sexual organs. God created them. I was speaking to Natan Alexander today. I'll mention him he has a website in which he is selling sex accessories, if you will. Again, a very modest website that is meant to enhance sexual pleasure in the marital relationship. And he quoted to me a book today by a very ultra-Orthodox rabbi who basically said one mistake couples do is they equate, you know, the bathroom. What happens when you go to the bathroom? You teach your children modesty. That's where modesty belongs, right? That if you're considerate and modest and you have to go to the bathroom, that's okay. But that's the kind of place where, again, you're somewhat private or discreet about it. And the language in the ultra-Orthodox community is actually very, very discreet about using the bathroom. But he said what happens with couples is they bring that same attitude towards sexuality, and he rails against that. You don't treat the woman's body as if it's a body, you know, as if she's in the bathroom. There should not be overt modesty in the bedroom, meaning that's degrading the sexual act. And I thought that was very interesting, that again, he was, you know, we tend to think modesty, oh, you have to be modest in the bedroom and in the bathroom and everywhere. And he's saying, no, the modesty where you try to be discreet and more covered, if you will, in the bathroom does not apply to the bedroom. And he felt that was the antithesis of holiness, which again, interesting. Something perhaps we'll come back to. What I want to kind of move forward to, the right to sexual pleasure in the marital relationship, which we'll be talking about more fully in lecture number 5, I think it is. What I want to look at is this source in Nedarim, and this source is a very important source. It's probably the most extended and important text on the techniques of married sex in the Talmud. So we're going to look at that. And it really exposes the discomfort on one hand that some rabbis had with, you could just do whatever you want, you know, it's all about within our relationship having marital having pleasure, versus, it's good, it's the way we were created. So I'm going to read through this. Some of you may know it, I've brought it before. I'm going to skip down to Rabbi Yochanan ben Dabai. Rabbi Yochanan ben Dabai said, I'm on page 7. The ministering angels told me 4 things. People are born lame because they overturned their table. It's lahafochet hashulchan. Lahafochet hashulchan, it's a question what that means. I'll just say there's something called bia shekedarka. That's normal vaginal sex. Bia shelo kedarka in the Talmud is anal sex. And both are considered to be sex for the purpose of making a woman not a virgin. Okay, those are both. Anything else a woman can still be a virgin, but those two are acts that takes away her virginity. When you talk about turning the tables, the question is it talking about bia shaloka darka, this unnatural cohabitation, which nonetheless is considered to be an act of sexual intercourse, or are we talking about a flip where the woman's on top and the man's on the bottom? Okay, and so that will be, I always feel like it's important to be as clear as possible. The Talmud here uses a phrase that is not completely clear. So we're going to see where that goes. People are born lame because they overturned their table. So again, was that because they just flipped the position, or did they practice, bia shelo kedarka, anal sex? I'm on page 7. Page 7 out of 10. Are there limits? What? No, you have something else. You have a different source. Yeah, don't use that. Yes. Dumb because they kissed that place. That refers to the female sexual organ. Deaf because they converse during cohabitation. Blind because they look at that place. That, again, means the woman's sexual organ. Rabbi Yochanan ben Dabai certainly would reflect certain attitudes toward sexuality at the time. We're talking about 500 CE. This is the only place where ministering angels come in the entire Talmud to teach halakha. So, again, I'm getting that from Daniel Boyarin, not because I've learned the entire Talmud, but because he emphasizes that it's very unique to have ministering angels coming and giving this kind of advice. And the challenge is really interesting. Ima Shalom was asked, "Why are your children so exceedingly beautiful?" She replied, "Because he, my husband, converses with me neither at the beginning nor at the end of the night, but only at midnight. And when he converses, he uncovers a handbreadth and covers a handbreadth and is as though he were compelled by a demon." And she's talking about the sexual act, in case that wasn't clear. "And when I asked him, 'What is the reason for this?' he replied, 'So that I may not think of another woman, lest my children be as bastards.'" Lest my children be, if I think of another woman. Now that's interesting, because if a man, I guess if he thought of a married woman, that might create, but he takes very seriously this idea of being very moderate in one sexual act. We're going to see that it's rejected. This idea is rejected, although it appears in Shalom Dean's recent book about Skver Hasidim. He has quoted this piece about how to behave in bed. So clearly it reasserts itself after the Talmudic period, and I'll show you that in a minute. What's interesting is Ima Shalom and Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus are talking during sex, which is one of the things you're not supposed to be doing. So as moderate as they are, and I would say repressed as they are, if you will, as limited as they are in their sexual conduct, because Rabbi Eliezer takes very seriously this idea of being focused the entire time on his wife, they're talking, and if you notice, Rabbi Yochanan ben Damai says, you will have deaf children if you converse during cohabitation. So even Ima Shalom and her husband are not following the proscription of the ministering angels, Rabbi Yochanan ben Dabai. And so, the Talmud is bringing that as, even in this model of a very restrictive sexual relationship, and they're going to reject that in a moment, even they are not able to live up to the standards that Rabbi Yochanan ben Dabai is presenting as necessary. Amemar then said, "Who are the ministering angels?" "The rabbis. For if you say literally ministering angels, then why do Rabbi Yochanan said the law?" Basically, how can you reject the ministering angels? Well, they really weren't ministering angels. They were sages who were excellent like the ministering angels. For those who know the story of the oven of Achnai, it is not in heaven, that the sages are entitled to reject voices that come out of heaven because it is not in heaven, because Lo Bashamayim, the Torah was given to us to interpret. So, truth is, you could suggest that, yes, the sages rejected the ministering angels, but Amemar wants to make that a little less harsh. "A woman once came before Rebbe and said, 'Rebbe, I set a table.'" Now, again, she willingly set the table. Food euphemisms for sex are all over the Talmud. There's a lot of overplay between sexual desire and desire for food. "I set a table before my husband, but he overturned it. Rebbe replied, 'My daughter, the Torah has permitted you to him. What then can I do for you?' A certain other woman came before Rebbe," Rebbe Yehuda Hanasi, the editor of the Talmud, the Mishnah. "She said to him, 'Rebbe, I sent him the table,' and he turned it over. He said, 'How is this case different from fish?'" Now, I'm not going to relate to the fact that it seems a little callous or, hard. The way he responds to her may be a little crude. But I will say that essentially what Rebbe is saying is, whatever goes on in your bedroom stays in your bedroom. It's fine. You don't need to come and ask questions about it. That is your right as a wife and husband. I'll just say, people often say to me, well, was it without her consent? Rape is out of the question in the Talmud, meaning marital rape is absolutely prohibited. If you take a look at the bottom, there are 9 categories where you will have children, you know, even worse than the children of the previous page, children of fright, children of rape, children of a despised woman, children of excommunication, and so on and so forth. In other words, it's very clear in the Talmud that a man cannot force his wife to do anything, right? So with that in mind, it seems like she might really have been coming with a, was it okay? I set the table. I thought we were going to do X, and suddenly we did Y, and I don't know if that's okay. And his answer is, yeah, it's totally fine. You didn't really need to ask me that question. And so here what we see is a little bit of the tension with Rabbi Yochanan ben Damai, who is absolutely rejected, and he remains rejected. We'll see him in a different class more carefully. And then the Imas Shalom and Rabbi Eliezer piece also seems to suggest, well, maybe midnight in the dark, uncover a little here, a little there. But ultimately, Rebbe, who is the stronger voice in this piece, comes and says, you know, the Torah permitted you to him. You, what can I do for you? Meaning, if you don't want to do it, tell him you don't want to do it. But there's no real problem here. I want to hand over to, I'm just going to turn to the last page. I'll just show you the excerpt. The 2 sources I didn't get to, somehow time goes very quickly. There's a story with a sage who has become celibate, and his wife hears him day in and day out begging for freedom from the tempter, from his sexual desire. And she says, I don't get it. We haven't had sex in years. Like, what is his problem? Like, what temptation? And basically, she seduces him. She dresses up as charuta, like a prostitute. And she seduces him, and he comes into the house and puts his head in the oven and basically says, oh, my God, I just want to die. And she's like, no, it's okay. It was me. It was me. I was the woman you slept with, so it's all good. And he's like, no. My intention was evil. So there, really, again, a story that really puts forward this tension that, you know, here's this sage who feels that sex must be bad. There must be something wrong with me for having sex, and yet and can't overcome that. Whereas in Shmot, in this source, which if you've been in my Midrash class, I bring it in every class I teach, God has to tell Moshe, why are you so angry about sexual desire? Sexual desire is the reason I have all these children went out of Egypt because the women seduced their husbands in the field, meaning Moshe wants to break their legs because he feels that mirrors are vanity. Again, you'll read it, you'll see what I mean. But again, it's God who has to come and say to him, you know, Moshe, not everyone could be you. And in fact, Moshe is not our model, meaning Lo kam b'Yisrael k'Moshe od. There is no one else like Moshe, meaning that model of asceticism, of at a certain point it seems celibacy, of being close to God all the time, is not what we take from Moshe. That's not the model we take. Don't use that model. And Moshe here rebukes him for not understanding how important sexual desire is. I'll just close with this piece, and then I'll give it to Jody. The mitzvah Shulam Din, exerted from all who go, do not return. He's someone who lived with the Skver Hasidim he came from a Hasidic background, not Skver, and he joined the Skver Hasidim around the age of 14. He got married, he had 5 children, and he ultimately became a non-believer and had to leave Skver, got divorced and really lost custody of his children. Very sad story, very well written, and if anyone wants to read, it's a good book. The mitzvah, Rabbi Shraga Feivish explained, this is the day or two before he gets married, right? Because again, in some Hasidic circles, they only explain to the man. The woman is often given more preparation, but the man is actually told what the sexual act entails the day before. In Ger, I think it's the day of, but at least that's what I've heard, although your husband might be able to correct me. But they're told, the idea being that they not fantasize, meaning the concern being that if they know too much about what the sexual act is, they may start thinking about it and come to waste seed, and that would be a big sin. So the mitzvah of Rabbi Shraga Feivish explained must not be done when in a state of anger. It must not be done before daytime hours. It must not be done when drunk or after eating or before using the bathroom. It must not be done if she is brazen. It must not be done in the presence of sacred books or in the presence of a child. Most important of all, the mitzvah must be done the way it was done by the great sage Rabbi Eliezer, with awe and fear as if forced by a demon. And then they don't get pregnant. So again, someone comes to him and says, well, why aren't you pregnant? I gave him the rundown of our routine, parroting the directions I'd be given. We performed the mitzvah every Tuesday and Friday night after midnight, exactly as I'd been taught, always with holiness and purity at the forefront of our minds. We said the necessary prayers. We covered the windows with a quilt. We told stories of righteous men. We kissed twice, and then we did it quickly, as if forced by a demon. The vividness of those words proved extraordinarily effective in keeping the act sacred and devoid of pleasure. So I want to argue is that that phrase about forced like a demon is not really where normative, where Judaism really is about sexuality, but it is a description that ends up kind of reemerging post-Talmud, in the Kabbalah, in the Shulchan Aruch, and then in certain Hasidic sects, and it creates not a small, and I would like to think only in the Hasidic sects, but I think also, fortunately or unfortunately, in the more modern Orthodox world as well, this idea that maybe it's better to be like Rabbi Eliezer, that maybe Rabbi Eliezer, look, he's Rabbi Eliezer, and look what beautiful children they had. So maybe that's what we should strive for. And it's almost like, the rest of the piece, which is we don't rule that way, and a man can do whatever, and a wife can do whatever they want, and that's holiness also, kind of gets forgotten. Anyway, I'm going to stop here. I'm going to let Jody pick it up, and then we'll take some questions.
Okay, so as Nechama said earlier, our teamwork is more, Nechama being more of the academic, Talmudic, participant, and I'm coming from the more therapeutic side. And I thought it would be interesting a little bit for me to tell you what I come into contact with as a therapist, how it works being a religious sex therapist, and it's better. Okay, I have a softer voice. Sometimes that's a good thing. I actually have a megaphone at home, so my kids hear me, but it's not working, right? Okay, it's still not on, right?
Yes.
It is, you hear me? Okay. Okay. Okay, so how someone becomes a religious sex therapist or a sex therapist from a religious background, and how I pull all of those things together, which I can tell you right now is not an easy task, especially when you have kids and a husband. I want to connect to something that Nechama spoke about at the beginning in her introduction and also during her lecture, and that's the word passion. When we talk about sexuality, the word passion has a certain meaning. But when we talk about other things, the word passion comes into play as well. Not like when Nechama said she has a passion to study about this topic, that it brings her joy and curiosity. And the word curiosity is very important. Curiosity means we want to learn more, that we're open to learning more, that we get excited about learning more. We can be passionate about food, which we've discussed. We can be passionate about, in terms of sexuality. We could be passionate about our jobs. We could be passionate about our children. Passionate means being excited, being devoted, and being open and being curious. So that's something that's very important when you talk about sexuality. I'd like you all to sort of take a minute and think about what you felt when you saw that this course was being offered. Everyone can think about that, to themselves, and then think about what you felt when you decide, I think I am going to register for that course. You may have started thinking a little bit, and then we have this nice balance between thinking and feeling. You may be thinking, oh, that will be very interesting to learn more academically about halacha and sexuality. At the same time, you may have had a little bit of a flutter in your heart or a little bit of a flip in your kishkas, or maybe not, right? Everyone is going to experience it a little bit differently. You may be thinking tonight, before you came here, like I was, like, oh, wow, things are sort of falling apart all around us, and Jerusalem is not the safest place to be. I came from outside of Jerusalem. I don't know how many of you came from outside of Jerusalem and how many of you, your lives are in Jerusalem, and just like I drove on 443 to get here because that's my life and that's something that I have to do, you may have come down to Tel Piot because that's part of your lives. And what you were thinking then, whether it was difficult or it wasn't difficult. And, I came and I'm like surprised to see such a full crowd tonight. And I'm very, very happy. And one of the reasons that may be part of this is that sexuality is a life force. It's a it represents life, whether we talk about it as bringing life, right, as procreation, or because it gets our blood flowing. It gets those butterflies flapping their wings. It gets us to feel like we're alive in one way or another very, very often. And very often, what's another very important thing, and when you talk about sexuality, is humor. So when I speak, there may be a little bit more humor, and it's okay to chuckle, and it's okay to giggle, and it's okay to wiggle in your seats. That's all fine. And it actually helps, because when we laugh, we release the tension a little bit. And speaking about sexuality, very often, will bring up tension. So it's okay to laugh. It's okay to, you know, we talk about the elephant in the room. We're bringing the elephant to the forefront. I usually have in my clinic, in my office at in Modi'in, I have, like, on my bookshelf, I have a big elephant. So when couples come in, I'm like, oh, so what brought you here tonight? You know, like this. You know, so, you know, the elephant's already in the room, so let's just talk about him. So that's very important. I want to also connect to another thing that you said about Vidavak in Parashat Bereishit, when it says Vidavak, Al ken yazov ish et aviv et imo, Vidavak b'ishto, v'yula basar echad. That Davak is really the creation of the us, I think. That when God creates man, God creates women, but woman, when they come together as partners, that adhesion, that connectedness brings them together in a with a joint plight in life. So when you talk about intimacy, sexual intimacy, and emotional intimacy amongst a couple, whatever that couple is composed of, there's an us that has to be taken into consideration. It's not just what's good for me or what's good for you. It's what works for us. And that's something that I work on a lot with my clients. When I was trying to think, Nechama asked me to speak about, you know, the trials and tribulations of becoming a religious sex therapist. So in my mind, you know, all the books, you know, from Muncie to Jerusalem or from wherever to Sinai or all these books. So I was thinking, okay, from the bubble to the bedroom, because I really grew up in a bubble. I grew up in Philadelphia. We grew up together in Philadelphia. And we grew up in a very nice little sheltered modern Orthodox community. And, you know, it was, like I would say, it was a semi-permeable bubble. We had parents that talked to us, thank God, and that were very open and educated us very nicely. But we really, you know, does texting lead to mixed dancing? Oh, what's mixed dancing? You know, and not because we were like so frummy, but it just wasn't in our lives. So how did I become a sex therapist? How do you do that? How do you negotiate that? What do people think of you? That was a big one. What do people think about say to your children? I was talking to my daughter about it today. She's like, Mommy, you have no idea what it's like to be the daughter of a sex therapist. If any of you watch Masters of Sex, any of you watch, show of hands, Masters of Sex on TV about Masters and Johnson? They were the mama and papa of the sexual research in the 1960s. Their children really mekachvim. They star in it. You know, they star in it in terms of how do you survive as the son or daughter of the sex therapist, especially if you're religious. And you do. It's not easy. She told me to tell the story of my son, and I'm just going to tell this very quickly, and then we're going to go a little bit more into what I work with. I walked into, when I first started studying, my son was in fourth grade. He's now 15. And I went into his room because it smelled. And I had to clean out his backpack because it reeked. And as I'm cleaning out his backpack, I find the moldy cucumber. How many of you have done that, right? The moldy cucumber. And I also found a note. Now, I don't tend to, you know, dig through and read my kids' stuff. But I saw it said something about sex. It had the word sex on it. So I said, okay, here's an opportunity. Sex therapist. Let's see what you're going to do with this one. I could have just crumpled it up and thrown it out, you know, and you're just taking a deep breath and that's it. But I decided to call him up. I said, honey, come on upstairs. I want to have a talk with you. First of all, your backpack stinks. Your backpack stinks and you have to learn right? Parenting 101, we educate our children. We also educate our children about sex. And I said to him, I saw this note. Do you know what this means? And he says to me, sex? I said, yes. He says, yeah, that's what you do with people to make them feel better. He knows that I'm an art therapist, and he knows that I do art with people to help them feel better. So he thought if I'm a sex therapist, I do sex with people to make them feel better. I said, okay, let's take a deep breath and let's talk about this a little bit more. So we see that not only educating our children about their sexuality is important, but educating them about what we do is even more important. But that's a good way, and we're going to talk about that in like one of the sessions, three or four. We're going to talk about how to educate our children and to use all of these, next session, and to use all these little opportunities that come along you know, with our kids, to educate them and to educate ourselves in how to approach them. It's very difficult to train as a sex therapist. Today was the first day of the program at Bar-Ilan, which is where I studied for this year's group, and I have a friend who actually just started. And I was trying to remember what I went through that day when you go and you're really exposed to all these people from, most of them were non-religious, most of them. Myself and one other Haredi woman from Har Nof were in the program at that time. So it was like I didn't know what to do with myself. She wore her sunglasses most of the time, which I thought was great because she was there and she was studying, but that was her comfort level. And all these things are going through my head. I'm thinking, oh my God, what am I doing here? I have to watch all of these things. I have to hear all of these words. I'm a good firm girl. I went to, Jewish day school from day one. I know how to protect myself from things that are just inappropriate. They're just not okay. And granted, I was married for quite a while with 5 kids already and Baruch Hashem, like a very good, happy marriage. But this is just not something for me to be exposed to. Is this dirty? Is this like a toeva, an abomination, which we'll be talking about? All these words start coming in my head from my studies in the past. What am I going to do with it? Is this even halachically okay? I mean, I know that David Ribner said, and he studied in YU, that it's okay, but how can this be okay? I don't understand it. And I had so many questions, and the process was so important to my professional training and my personal training to learn that not only is it okay, but it's okay to feel like it's not okay. It's okay to feel a little bit freaked out. It's okay to feel a little bit guilty. It's okay to feel very confused. And what's the most okay is to be able to work through your confusion and to understand it. So when we speak here, and I see that in terms of religious levels, I don't even know what's going on in the room, who's who and what you believe. The idea is we're all human beings, and God created all of us, and God also created all of our bodies, and we have to learn them. We have to learn our bodies. We have to accept our bodies, and we have to learn how to gain pleasure from our bodies, and we also have to learn how to feel a little uncomfortable with our bodies at times. I think they go hand in hand. And as Nechama said, the Jewish sources are the most wonderful resource. The same son grew up a few years, funny, I'm talking about the same one, for his bar mitzvah, he was learning Masechet Brachot, tractate of Brachot, blessings. And he's in the other room learning with my husband, and they start talking about the spilling of the seed of Keri, right? And I was working, and I said to my husband, Josh, here's your opportunity. And he looks at me and he says, I'm an orthodontist. You're the sex therapist. And I say, well, the father's supposed to talk to the sons and the mother's supposed to talk to daughters. He's like, no way. But so I went in and we did it together. We just sat down and we said, oh, do you know what this means? And he's like, yeah, I know what this means. And then it's another opportunity. Yeah. You'll hear more about him. So we have all of this beautiful, beautiful, all these beautiful opportunities within Jewish studies that we can use to our benefit and know that, yeah, I wrote this down very nicely, if I may say so myself, is that we have all of these Jewish sources, whether it be Tanakh, Talmud, rabbinic questions and answers, that all recognize that sexuality is a part of human beings. Human beings were created by God, so sex was created by God, and it is good and holy and important, and we need to work with this and not against this. I'll tell you very briefly in the next 2 minutes just a few of the types of cases that I get. What's interesting is generally what I find with my colleagues is that different people are attracted to different therapists. So tonight I'll tell you a few, just like two or three categories of the people that I work with, but this is not the only thing that sex therapists work with. And the ones that are connected a little bit more to Judaic or halachic issues. The sexual desire continuum, and the word continuum is very, very important. We talk an incompatibility between husband and wife, or between partners. So if we're going to talk about sexual incompatibility, very often we're going to find that in other areas there's incompatibility as well. Sometimes they present as couples therapy clients, not sex therapy clients, and then we see that there's a lot of incompatibility. Sexual desire issues can come from feelings of, you know, having a high sexual desire before you get married, and the guilt that some of these young couples feel for having fooled around or been sexually active, which we're using, and Nechama used that also, sexuality. We're not talking necessarily about intercourse. We're talking about the concept of sexuality and what happens when you feel that before you get married, and then after you get married, you're like, whoa, what's going on here? This was so great, but now it's not so great. So that's one thing that I talk about a lot. The issues of tarat mishpacha, which is nida, menstruation, and family purity. The laws can be very difficult. Many people learn before they get married that it's beautiful and it's all wonderful, and the idea of separating and coming back, the perpetual honeymoon, it's not always so wonderful, and there's a lot of confusion and a lot of anxiety that can come from it. Not for everybody, especially not if you're taught by someone who is really educated and goes to the courses that Nechama mentioned in the past. So there can be anxiety, there can be pain, right? There can be expectations, there can be overwhelming feelings. So that's another category. The third category is incomplete sexual education, that put part A into part B is not all that it's about. I work with a variety of age range from people that are, I don't really work as a sex therapist with people before them. Not before they're married, I do, but as children, I work more with young adults and adults, up to people that have been married for 35 years that will come to me. And they'll say, since we got married, this has been a problem. Oh, really? You tell me a little bit about it. Oh, well, we have 5 children, and we have 5 children. It doesn't mean it was fun. It doesn't mean that it was fun sometimes, and that they went through different periods of their lives, that things change, and that happens. That's, again, it's a continuum. Things change. We'll talk about that when we talk about the life cycle. In terms of the level of religiosity, I've worked with from Haredi couples to people that are non-affiliated. Everybody, we're all humans. We all have issues. And the most important thing is to ask. And we saw from the second to last source that Nechama brought, that even in the times of the Talmud, women asked. They went up to the Rav, and they said, I set the table. He flipped it. I set the table. He this. He wants it like this. I want it like that. Do we talk? Do we not talk? How do we do this? We have to learn it. It's not something that comes naturally to everybody. It's like when we speak, it's a type of communication. We learn, we teach our children how to speak. We teach them by modeling. We teach them by books, by reading. We teach them in all different ways, and sexuality and sexual communication is the same thing. And hopefully over the next 6 weeks, we'll work on that together. And again, I'm reminding you, questions, anytime. You can write them down and submit them.